You may be seated. Thank you. The next case set for argument is News America Marketing and Farmington Casualty Company versus Destiny Scone. For appellants, we have Seth Lepore and J.G. Schultz. Both will be arguing. I understand Mr. Schultz or Mr. Lepore, you're going to take the first 15 minutes. Mr. Schultz, you'll have the rebuttal. And then Brad Lee will be arguing on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Scone. So, Mr. Lepore, you can proceed with your initial argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Seth Lepore, and along with Jeff Schultz, we represent the employer and insurer in this workers' compensation matter. Today, we're asking this court to reverse the circuit court for three reasons. First, it erred when it distinguished this case from this court's prior precedent in Armstrong v. Longview Farms. Second, it erred by finding claimants' experts more credible than that of Dr. Nipper. Third, it erred in failing to exclude Dr. Dietrich for his lack of foundation. Now, I'd like to begin just by noting that this court's decision in Armstrong and the parallels with this case are significant, and it should control the disposition in this case. In Armstrong, the claimant suffered two injuries to his knee prior to his work-related injury that was the subject of that lawsuit. Here, Ms. Schoen has three prior significant injuries that impacted her cervical spine. First, in 2001, she was rear-ended. She was diagnosed with whiplash. She complained of intermittent problems with her neck, upper back, and cervical pain. She even indicated to her treaters that since she was a child, she's had similar issues as this. Now, thereafter, she treated 86 times with complete chiropractic, choosing conservative treatment in order to treat the symptoms. Again, in 2003, she was rear-ended. Again, she's reporting pain in her neck, shoulders, and into the base of her neck. That's at the record at 1278. At this point, she was diagnosed with an aggravation of a prior cervical sprain, and she was treated for cervical segmental dysfunction. Now, just a year later, she suffered a slip and fall in 2004, where she broke her right wrist and also suffered an acute traumatic sprain of her neck. This again aggravated her prior neck issues. Now, the issues and the injuries that she suffered as a result of the slip and fall were so significant that she commenced a lawsuit against the city of Sioux Falls and other parties. And in this lawsuit, she alleged that she suffered permanent, lifelong injuries as a result of that slip and fall in combination with her prior motor vehicle accidents. Now, there's ample record evidence which supports the finding that she suffered permanent and long-lasting injuries from the slip and fall. She offered several medical opinions in that lawsuit that she would never recover from those injuries unless there was some treatment or some procedure to fix the issue. Well, ultimately, that lawsuit wasn't successful, and there was no compensation for these permanent injuries. So Ms. Schoen was left with nothing but to continue to treat for these injuries for years. She would continue to treat up until 2009, but again, that permanency remained because all she was doing was treating the symptoms and not the underlying issue that she had with her neck.
Counsel, in this case, unlike in Armstrong, it appears that there was an MRI that was conducted close in time to or after the most recent work injury that did show significant changes compared to the one that was taken in 2009. Isn't that a distinguishing factor in this case that was not present in Armstrong?
Your Honor, I do agree that the record does reflect that. However, my understanding is there's no way to carbon date or no way to actually place a specific date and time that an individual blows a disc or ends up requiring a need for replacement. There was an MRI after the injury, but there's nothing in the record to suggest that we know the exact date and time that she suffered that blown disc. And if we look back at the MRI records in 2009, it specifically mentions that there are bone spurs present. I believe that's evidence that that's evidence of permanent injuries, permanent degenerative condition. And also in that 2009 MRI is that there was minor displacement at the same cervical disc. So it's just continued evidence that Ms. Schoen had a natural downward progression in her cervical spine and those injuries that were a result from the motor vehicle accidents and the slip and fall.
Mr. Lepore, can I ask you a question about your, before we get into the facts, and I know we're into them, but before we get more into them, what's the legal error, right, in this case? The ALJ and the Circuit Court both, it seems, followed the rule for causation that's set out in 62.117 sub B. You agree that's the correct rule?
Yes, Justice.
So is it possible that Armstrong is just one fact-bound result, applying that rule, and this case is a different one?
Your Honor, I don't agree with that. I think from this court's decision in Hughes, it's been made very clear that the causation standard is not a percentage. It is not the major contributing cause. It only has to be a major contributing cause. My interpretation of Armstrong is that it's set kind of an outer limits on that standard. In Armstrong, it was very clear that the work injury was the tipping point of the degenerative condition that the claimant suffered from. If you read Armstrong and Hughes and Harmony, I believe that Armstrong just establishes that a tipping point is not a significant enough injury. It's not that substantial contributing factor that's required under the causation standard under 61.1.
Well, that would involve and seem to implicate factual issues that may well be unique to each case, I would expect. So isn't the determination, and I hate to substitute tipping point as sort of a colloquialism, and maybe you're right, but isn't it a factual question that's unique to each case as to when the causation standard is met, and if it's a tipping point theory, that determination is made upon the facts, some of which include actual testimony that was given in person.
That's true, Your Honor. I agree with the court's suggestion that it is a fact and case-by-case specific inquiry. I don't believe this court or any court would want to take the laboring oar in determining which injury is a tipping point, which injury is significant enough to be a major contributing cause. And I believe that's why the causation standard defers substantially to the expert recommendations and opinions in each case, and why it is so dependent on the facts of each case. But to answer your original question, Justice Salter, the error here is that the department and the circuit court ignored crucial evidence. In an effort for the department and the circuit court to distance themselves from Armstrong, they identified paragraph 24 of the Armstrong opinion and noted that there is no record evidence that Ms. Schoen's condition worsened leading up to the injury. The Department of Labor also noted that there was no symptoms and that she didn't treat during that time. All of these conclusions are inaccurate. With respect to the circuit court's decision, we know that, like Armstrong, Ms. Schoen suffered from degenerative disc disease. She had that at least since 2001 and likely prior to that. But so we know that from 2009 to 2015, her discs continue to degenerate. Her condition is worsening, like that in Armstrong. With respect to the department's finding about symptoms and treatment, the claimant herself admitted that she suffered from flare-ups throughout that entire time, and that to get by, she'd cut up whatever remaining flexor patches she had in order to alleviate the pain. Now, the circuit court selectively used Merriam-Webster to define certain medical terms, but Merriam-Webster defines a flare-up as a sudden appearance or worsening of the symptoms of a disease or condition. These flare-ups are symptoms. And the record also supports a finding that she did not have health insurance from October 2010 to June 2015. Without health insurance, she couldn't afford to go treat.
But the causation standard in subsection B contemplates pre-existing disease or condition. The whole causation standard is premised upon that factual sort of launch point. So that one, that shouldn't distinguish this case from any other case that we consider under subsection B, or the ALJ does, should it?
I think the distinguishing aspect of this case in Armstrong is this case has a much more significant treatment history. This case has more significant prior injuries. It has a more clear degenerative permanent condition. In particular, Ms. Schoen commenced a lawsuit alleging permanent injuries as a result of her slip and fall. There is expert testimony from that lawsuit that she will never recover until some procedure is conducted. And that procedure was after the workplace injury.
Go ahead.
Can you provide me a citation to the record that would support the inference that it's this exact spot in her, this disc that's injured in the slip and fall? I mean, is that what you're saying, that it's this exact spot?
Your Honor, I'm not...
Where should I look in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. I would point this court to pages 523 through 524, as well as page 1574. And I'll be perfectly frank with the court. I don't believe that it does identify C5-6 as the specific disc that was injured as part of that injury. However, if even just a cursory review of the record shows that Ms. Schoen complained for 15 years of shoulder and neck pain. In some of the notes, she says since she was 4, she's had pain in her neck and her shoulders, and it radiates to several limbs. So that permanent pre-existing condition is there. So the question then becomes whether or not there's sufficient expert testimony to support a finding that there was a major contributing cause. And on
Mr.
this...
Mr. Lepore, I want to move you up to Dr. Diedrich's opinion and the motion to strike or the objection to the foundation for his testimony. Do you think that was adequately preserved in front of the department?
Yes, Your Honor. If the court looks at the deposition of Dr. Diedrich, Mr. Schultz interposed an objection before any of the opinions were given to a lack of foundation.
Right, but it wasn't raised at the pre-hearing conference, and it wasn't raised at the hearing itself. There was no objection. Am I correct about that?
There was an objection at the hearing, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not at the pre-hearing conference, but it was preserved at the hearing.
So there was a specific objection during the hearing?
Your Honor, I believe the interaction was a presentation of the depositions of the experts, and I believe Mr. Schultz made a comment subject to the objections contained therein. So I do believe it was preserved.
Okay.
Regardless of the objections posed at the deposition or the hearing, the Department of Labor is free to choose between conflicting expert testimony and also has an obligation as the gatekeeper to ensure that those expert opinions have sufficient facts and data under 19.19.702. Dr. Diedrich was provided a 32-page summary by counsel and provided only select records from that summary. That's all Diedrich had. I understand he was a treating physician, but if we compare that to Dr. Nipper, who had 15 years of medical records before him and an independent medical about an in-person IME.
Is that the standard for Daubert, comparing what one expert has versus another? Doesn't that go to, Mr. Schultz cross-examined Mr. Diedrich and his, or Dr. Diedrich in his deposition, raised some of those issues, did you know this, did you know those things? Isn't that how you address foundation issues?
That's correct, Your Honor. If the court was unwilling to strike Dr. Diedrich at a very minimum, when it's determining whether or not Dr. Nipper is more credible than claimant's experts, there has to be some kind of evaluation of what the foundation is for those opinions. This court in Hughes held that an expert's opinion is no better than the foundation from which it's based on. Well, if Dr. Diedrich is only provided 32 pages of a medical timeline and cherry-picked records, how can he possibly have a full understanding of Ms. Schoen's pre-existing degenerative condition?
What of significance would have been in the actual records that is not in the summary, in your view?
In particular, Your Honor, the records from the lawsuit are absolutely crucial. Ms. Schoen provided several opinions from 2004 all the way up until 2008, December of 2008, that she was permanently and lifelong injured by that slip and fall, including her neck, including her shoulder. Those records about the permanency and those injuries were absolutely crucial to have a full understanding of Ms. Schoen's medical history, and that's required under Armstrong and under this court's precedent. With that, appellants would ask this court to reverse the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. The overriding issue the appellants want this court to change is the decision the department of the circuit court came up with. And Justice Salter, your comments were right on point with regard to what we're dealing with here, because personal injury are just that, personal. Every case is unique. All the facts are unique. When you have prior injuries, prior medical treatment. And counsel led off with Armstrong. Armstrong is easily distinguishable for three reasons. In Armstrong, he had prior injuries, and in 2005, he had a meniscal surgery, and the doctor said, you need your knee replaced. What did he do? He says, I don't want to do it because knee replacements don't last forever. So prior to his work injury, he was told you need a knee replacement. For the ensuing 10 years, he continues to go to the doctor and treat for knee injuries. And the records note, according to the opinion, his knee is getting worse and worse. The pain is getting worse and worse. Finally, he has this subsequent injury. He does get the knee replacement, and they also replace his right knee. Destiny Schoen is completely different. In September of 2009, after she had the injections from Dr. Lawler in July, and that's the significant point, that's when she got better. She had these steroid injections in her neck that took away the inflammation and pain. September of 2009, she goes to Black Hills Orthopedic, and they say, listen, we can't help you. You're not a surgical candidate. You can't have surgery. So prior to this work injury, she's specifically told, unlike Armstrong, you can't have surgery. From 2010 to 2015, she does not go to get medical treatment for her neck. There is one medical record that said she had a flare-up when she had physical therapy for a work comp knee injury, but that's the only record. That's the other distinguishing factor from Armstrong. And then finally, in Armstrong, the doctor says, yeah, I can't, his treating doctor says, I can't point to anything that would indicate you had an acute injury on any of the objective medical evidence. In this case with Destiny Schoen, Wilson, the neurosurgeon, compared the two MRIs from 2009 and 2015 and says, there is new pathology on this MRI, and offers her surgery, which she does perform. So those are the three easy ways you can distinguish Armstrong, aside from what Justice Salter said about how these personal injuries are so fact-dependent.
Well, the other distinction here is that Armstrong, you're coming up on a requesting the court to affirm the decision of the department. Here the request is to reverse the department. You have a claimant testifying in both cases. We give deference to that.
Absolutely.
Testimony. There's a distinction there as well.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of does a segue. I know they didn't touch much on it about the credibility discussion, but I know, Justice Salter, you asked about what's the legal issue. For some of the arguments that the appellants are bringing up, there is absolutely no authority for what they're arguing. And let's talk about the credibility issue. There is no statute, no case law that says that a Department of Labor judge has to make an explicit determination on a claimant's credibility. Because quite frankly, sometimes it's not an issue, right? Sometimes the facts are not in dispute and it's an argument between two doctors, which is really what we're dealing with here. And despite the judge not making an explicit credibility determination, I think it's pretty clear she implicitly found in favor of Destiny Schoen because she got a fully favorable decision.
Well, she made specific findings of fact that said she didn't treat from 2009 to 2015.
Correct.
She worked 60 hours a week. So it seems like she's crediting that testimony by finding that to be a fact.
Absolutely. And, you know, another issue they touch on in their brief is, and Mr. Lepore talked about it, is that the court committed error when it found that she didn't have symptoms between 2010 and 2015. Well, that's not true. You can look at one, the hearing transcript, Destiny Schoen testified. She did have flare-ups. Why? Because it's the truth. She had flare-ups, but they'd go away. She was able to work, like Justice Salter said, 60 hours a week, play softball. But the department specifically found that she did have occasional flare-ups, and that's in Finding of Fact 27. The circuit court, in pages 9 and 10 of Judge Klinger's opinion, said the flare-ups Schoen had from 2010 to 2015 did not affect her daily life and did not require treatment. Again, found occasional flare-ups on page 10. But the appellants also stated, not only in their initial brief, but also the reply, on page 19 of their initial brief, the DLR acknowledged these flare-ups in its findings of fact. On their reply brief on page 3, they admitted, the DLR made a specific finding that claimant suffered from flare-ups. That's not a question of fact. The department found it because it's the truth. Nobody disputes that. The other aspect that they bring up, and he didn't really touch on it in his argument, is her testimony in her deposition when she talked about pain versus pressure. I was there. Mr. Schoen asked her, where were you feeling pain on the date of the injury, May 7th, 2015? She said it was in her shoulder. That's where she felt pain. At hearing, she testified how she also felt pressure in his neck. If you look at that deposition, they never questioned her about her neck or if she felt anything else. It was just where she felt pain. And I want you to kind of keep in mind when this deposition happened. It was 3.5 years after her injury. Okay? They're trying to create a credibility issue when we know she had pain in her neck because she had neck surgery. Dr. Wilson would not have performed surgery on her neck a year after the injury if she didn't have pain. When you look, and I made a note of it, Mr. Lepore said that the records between 2010 and 2015 are the crucial records to this case. If you read the cross-examination of Dr. Dietrich and the examination of Nipper and the examination of Destiny Schoen at the hearing, none of these records are even referenced. If these are the crucial records that show everything that the appellants claim, then why wouldn't they ask Dr. Dietrich about them? Why wouldn't they introduce them to Nipper? Why wouldn't they ask Destiny Schoen? You look at the hearing transcript, they don't even ask her how she was doing between 2010 and 2015. Don't even ask a question. Don't ask about her treatment. Don't ask about her neck pain. Nothing. So if these records are crucial, then how can you claim the Department of Labor abused its discretion, was clearly erroneous, or even under a de novo review? How can you claim the department was wrong when the opposing counsel didn't even introduce these records into evidence? The first time these records are introduced were in the reply brief to the circuit court, Judge Klinger, in the reply, not their initial brief. And you'll note, if you read that transcript, I marked all the exhibits as Exhibit 1, I highlighted them, and gave them to Judge Klinger and went through them. I've got them right here. None of these records have anything to do with neck pain or treatment between 2010 and 2015. None of them. And now in their reply brief to this court, they cite additional records, DAI 530 and 31 through DI 1781. DI 530 is a record from Community Health where she's getting a refill of prescriptions for amoxicillin and Trinessa. Amoxicillin has nothing to do with neck pain. It's an antibiotic. Trinessa is a birth control pill. You go through these records. The next one, Rapid City Medical Center, June 7th, 2015. Urgent care, possible broken right foot, tripped downstairs last night. Has nothing to do with neck pain. The only time that there's ever reference to neck pain is in 2014 when she's there for a right knee injury that was a work comp claim. And she says she had physical therapy for her right knee and it flared her neck and arm pain. That was the only reference. She got a prescription that day for a flexor patch. It's for her knee. How do we know it's for her knee? Because it's a workers' compensation claim. A work comp insurer is not going to pay for medical treatment for a neck when the only claim is a right knee injury.
Can you respond to the argument made by Mr. LaPorra regarding the records from the lawsuit?
Yes and no, Justice Kern, because these records were never brought up to any of the experts in the record below. Did she have injuries to her neck? Absolutely. No dispute about that. But that case, this case was not about whether she came in Lily White, Virgin Snow. We know she had prior neck injuries. And that's just what Justice Salter talked about when he was talking about the workers' compensation statute. We have a pre-existing disease and pre-existing injury case law and statutes for a reason, because people get hurt. And the whole case is about those 5 years where she's not treating. And they referenced the fact that she lost her health insurance and that's why she didn't treat for her neck pain. Well, one, that's not substantiated in any of the testimony at the hearing or with the doctors. But two, if you look at these records, she was treating. I mean, I'm holding them up here. She had went to the doctor for like those medications I talked about. She had irritable bowel syndrome. She had a colonoscopy. She treated consistently throughout that. And if you look at their brief, they cite to appellant's brief at page 26. They cite to Appendix C. It's a medical summary that the appellants put together. I assume a paralegal. I don't know. First and foremost, it was never made a part of the record. My medical summary was Exhibit 2, admitted into evidence. Their medical summary was not. I have no objection for you to look at it because I want you to. Look at their summary of the medical records from 2010 to 2015. Even their own summary doesn't list that she's treating at any of these facilities for neck pain. It's not there. And so I find it very difficult to come here and say that the department and the circuit court committed error when the very arguments they're making now to this court were never presented to any of the witnesses below. It's hard to say that Judge Faw made a mistake when the evidence was not even presented to her. One issue I want to talk about is the decision to strike Dr. Dietrich's opinion. Chief Justice Jensen, I think you made a good point. I don't think this argument was preserved, but Judge Faw didn't address it, and I'm quite frankly under an abuse of discretion. It's probably not an issue that we get at. But if you look at just Dr. Dietrich, he reviewed all of this information. I mean, his partner is Brett Lawler at the rehab doctors. Brett went on sabbatical. That's why Dr. Dietrich took over for Dr. Lawler. But as a standard practice, Dr. Dietrich testified to this. He reviewed all of these records. He looked at the Black Hills orthopedic records. He looked at all of the rehab doctors' records. He looked at promotion records, Black Hills Ortho, Black Hills Neuro, my medical summary. But then he also testified he was aware that she'd had two motor vehicle accidents. He was aware that she had prior whiplash. He was aware that she had prior chiropractic. And he testified to that in his deposition on page 26. But even in cross-examination, Mr. Schultz conceded that Dr. In a preface to a question, he said, you're aware of her prior car or accident or prior injuries. Dr. Dietrich said yes. And I went back to Dr. Dietrich. I'm like, Dr. Dietrich, as we sit here today, are you willing and capable to look at any medical record of Destiny that she had prior to seeing you and to formulate your opinions? Absolutely. Did he present any of these records that we're talking about here today on appeal? Absolutely not. And I think that's significant because treating doctors do not get to examine these patients in a vacuum, right? They're very busy people for the most part. That's why you take a history and exam. Nothing that Destiny Schoen told Dr. Dietrich was impeached or attacked for being not credible. And I think that's important because what the objection was, it says, Dr. Dietrich cannot state his opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability without having seen each and every document, each and every record pertaining to this patient's pre-injury condition. Well, I think that argument is actually contrary to Rule 703. I don't think I put it in our brief. Because 703 says, the basis of the expert opinion may be derived from facts or data that the expert has been made aware of or personally observed. Destiny made him aware that she had these prior injuries. Dr. Dietrich considered that in formulating his opinions. And even if the basis of the opinion is not to the appellant's satisfaction, Stormo v. Strong says, challenge to factual basis for expert testimony went to the weight of the evidence, not the admissibility. And in Reed, South Dakota, the antitrust litigation with Microsoft, the trial process is well-equipped to deal with contradictory opinions. Vigorous cross-examination, presentation of contrary evidence, and careful instruction on the burden proof are the traditional and appropriate means of attacking shaky but admissible evidence. They had every opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Dietrich and submit these records through Dr. Nipper and chose not to. And Judge Devaney, I think you, again, coming back to what Mr. Lepour said to you, the records that he's referencing in his reply brief that I'm holding here are the crucial evidence. And they never, ever presented it to any of the witnesses to have them offer opinions for the department to consider. I find it hard to believe that you could argue that that's an abuse of discretion or clear error or even under a de novo rule wrong. So I'd ask that the court affirm the circuit court and Department of Labor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Schultz, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this matter with you. The most central point in this case is medical testimony. Medical testimony is the key to the workers' compensation causation standards. Why? Because we have two versions, one of which is a major contributing cause, but that only applies when the person has a pre-existing non-work-related condition. That's what Byram says. The other standard is contributing factor, independently contributed to the condition. That is when the previous condition is work-related. It's a lower burden. Byram says that too. So you have this higher standard here, a major contributing cause. We've had a lot of thought about that. Maybe it's like contributory negligence. I don't know if there's any way to really get that tacked down, but I do think that every time that somebody comes in front of this court or the Department of Labor and says, I have a major contributing cause for my workplace, and we all know I have a pre-existing condition, in this case, a lot. There's a lot of records over there. For demonstrative purposes, I will just make this comment. There's two of these binders on the bottom here. There's actually three total. Two of those, pardon me, the one on the top with the yellow stripe on it, that's what Dr. Dietrich saw. The other two, he didn't.
Probably not too much of that pile of medical records relates to anything from 2009 or 2015, however,
correct,
as I understand it.
Correct.
And this is a theory that Dr. Nipper had that the Ms. Schoen sort of said, I'm going to forgo treatment because I need it, but I'm going to forgo it because I don't have insurance. I've read her testimony, but I can't recall it right now. Was she cross-examined on this theory that she, in fact, needed treatment, didn't get it, and the reason why was because she didn't have insurance?
I do not believe that's in the hearing transcript, Your Honor. Sorry to say.
But wouldn't that be one way to test that theory? I mean, otherwise, I guess it's just Dr. Nipper saying, oh, you know, surely she had pain but didn't, and I'm theorizing that that's because she didn't have insurance. I mean, you could ask her, you could pursue it with her and see what she says about it.
Certainly. The difference is, Justice, though, is that you can look at the records. The medical records tell you, because she told her treaters, I'm not getting this treatment because I don't have the insurance. So,
I understand your argument, and I appreciate it as well at the outset. So this is highly dependent upon medical testimony, and I appreciate your argument. But surely the claimant and the claimant's testimony play a role. How would you sort of factor that piece of the evidentiary record into the total determination that we have in these cases?
First of all, I'll start with a premise that the claimant has self-interest. They will present the best case they can. I don't think that that's crazy talk. I think that's, in fact, the law.
For which they can be impeached.
Correct. And however, one way to test what they say is to look at their own records. Why? Because when they're telling the doctor what they're doing, it's an exception to hearsay. Why? Because it's designed to elicit treatment. Okay? So that information comes in as her. Basically, it's an exception to hearsay, so it comes into evidence. So I think that one can test those theories by reference to the medical records.
But where in those prior records that you just mentioned does it refer to her saying, I really need treatment, I really need a neck surgery, but I don't have insurance?
I can't point one out like that, Your Honor. Sorry to say, I cannot do that. I can say, however, that she did have symptoms, and everybody agrees with that, right? We've got that clear now. She had symptoms. She had flare-ups. She had symptoms in those critical periods. Why? Because she said so.
So was she impeached with reference to the testimony that she's working 60 hours a week, exploring, living an active lifestyle, playing softball, et cetera?
That was not pursued. If I may just hit two points here before I get off. One is, for some reason, neither the Department of Labor nor the Circuit Court mentioned the fact that this lady had a wrist injury sufficient enough to break her wrist when she was in Sioux Falls and fell in the arena, and that brought on pain and discomfort up and down the arm, resulted in surgery. That's a big deal. That's not just minor, and I lost my time.
You can make your second one real quick.
Okay, my second one is that... it's actually a repeat to some degree of what Mr. LaPerse said. I won't repeat it then. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. I want to thank counsel for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess.